From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is the Autosport Podcast. Welcome to the latest episode of our picking out of the favourite F1 season as part of the 75th celebration of both Autosport and the World Drivers' Championship. We're going to have some special guests to talk about their favourite F1 season, pick out some of the storylines, why they like it, and potentially ask why they might be wrong at picking it as their favourite season. So for this episode, I'm going to welcome our deputy editor of the magazine, Marcus Simmons. Marcus, are you looking forward to this? Your era is predictable. I predicted which era you would pick for yours.
Yeah. I think you got the right era. I think you were 1 year out.
I was
out,
a couple of years out with my prediction. It's
fairly safe ground, I'd say. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get started then. So I guess let's go with which year have you chosen and a brief overview of why.
Right. I've chosen 1977, and the reason is it's that old cliche where you think the golden era is whatever was making you absolutely obsessed as a youngster, and
when life was simpler.
Yeah, when life was simple, and all you had to do was go out on your bike and muck around with your friends and things like that. And so 1977, I was 10 years old. I was, as I say, absolutely obsessed with motorsport in general, and Formula One was obviously the peak of that. And we, as a dad and lad, me and my dad used to go quite regularly to Thruxton, my local circuit. But the pilgrimage to Silverstone for the British Grand Prix was the highlight of the year. And we, in those days, there was no Formula One on TV. The BBC weren't yet doing their Grand Prix half hour highlights on Sunday evening. So all we had to go on was a brief newspaper report on the Sunday morning to find out what the grid was. And then Simon Taylor, ex of this parish of Autosport, on Radio 2 at 6 o'clock on the Sunday evening, telling us what had happened in the Grand Prix. And beyond that, all the only way you could find out in detail what happened was through Motoring News and Autosport. It was something that it wasn't accessible to my friends either. They all followed football, whatever, you know, which young lads tend to do. I followed motorsport, and it was something that I regarded as my little thing, until James Hunt went and won the 1976 World Championship, and then suddenly all my mates
got
interested. So we went to Silverstone. We also that year in 77 went to the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort. My dad, I don't know how he did it, but he convinced my mum that a 2 week holiday in the second half of August to the North Sea coast in Holland would be a great family holiday.
Good work.
It just happened to coincide with the Dutch Grand Prix. So well done, Dad. So we got to see two Grand Prix that year, and just the absolute duration as well. So yeah, in 77, as an odd numbered year, the Grand Prix was at Silverstone, and the Grand Prix was always on Saturdays at Silverstone back then. So we turned up on the Wednesday with our tent to be there in time for qualifying, and we arrived at the track on the Wednesday, and we could hear Formula One cars going round, and we thought, what's going on here? And it was the pre-qualifying day that they'd added on before the 3 days of the conventional meeting. So we decided not to pitch the tent immediately and went over to the track and saw Gilles Villeneuve driving a McLaren Formula One car for the first time, and Patrick Tombay in an Ensign. Went over to the paddock at lunchtime and got their autographs.
Oh, that's cool.
And then and a few weeks later at Zandvoort, we'd got wind that there was going to be pre-qualifying there as well. But that was on the Tuesday, and the actual meeting proper didn't start till the Friday. So we had 4 days of Formula One at those two circuits, and it was just a golden summer as far as I was concerned.
I don't think there's any way my dad would have got away with that level of motor racing on a holiday. But so at Zandvoort, you'd have seen Niki Lauda win. Who went on to win the world championship, and at Silverstone you'd have seen James Hunt win the reigning world champions. That's quite appropriate.
We did, and we also at Zandvoort, my dad and I had walked around the track on the Saturday evening to select our vantage point, and we decided to watch at the second corner, the one after Tarzan, on the sand dune overlooking it. So we saw the Andretti Hunt collision.
Well, what was your take on that? That was quite controversial, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yeah. Yes, so it was controversial, very much so, between the two drivers involved. it did look as though James Hunt had taken him off, which I think most people tended to agree with.
Yeah, when your defence is people don't drive around the outside there, that's probably not a very good. That's not a good start to your defence, is it? But there's pictures of one of them up in the air, isn't there? Because they clashed wheels or something.
They did. Yeah.
Well, just before we get into a bit more detail, we probably should say, obviously, for those that don't know, so 1977 World Championship was Niki Lauda's second title, and once he got it won, he walked away for the last two races. We'll get to that in a minute. Ferrari won the constructors' title, but actually, it was the wins were spread around quite a lot. We had eight different winners for six different teams. Imagine that now, six teams winning races. That'd be incredible. So, I guess, Marcus, we should start with neither the Ferrari nor Niki were the fastest combination that year. It was pretty obvious, really, that a new innovation had arrived, or maybe it wasn't obvious at the time, given that he didn't win either title.
No, it wasn't really. I mean, you have to remember that Lotus were on the bounce back after a period in the doldrums, and Mario Andretti had won the Japanese Grand Prix at the end of the 1976 season, but no one regarded Lotus as a title contending team or anything like that. But obviously the Lotus 78 for 1977 was the three quarters way house towards the Lotus 79 of 1978 with ground effects and what have you. So Andretti won the most races in 77. In hindsight, we would now sit here and say, well, so he should have done, because of what we subsequently know from how good the car was the following season. So the Ferrari, on the other hand, it was the same 312 T2 that the team had used in 1976. The Goodyear tyres changed slightly, didn't they, for 77. So they were a little bit behind the curve on that until the middle of the 77 season. And also, you know, obviously, put it into the context of what had happened to Lauda in 76. I mean, he'd had the very serious accident at the German Grand Prix that year, which also we went to, actually, but we were supposed to in 76. The plan was to have a really long family holiday in the school summer holidays and take in the Nürburgring, the Austrian Grand Prix and the Dutch Grand Prix.
Oh, wow.
But then rather brilliantly, I got rushed into hospital in early May of 76 with what the doctors thought was leukemia. And I was having all sorts of tests done, and it must have been really terrifying for my family. I didn't really know, but it turned out it was a disease called purpura, which is a little bit similar to haemophilia, where if you cut yourself, the blood doesn't stop flowing, basically. So I was under orders not to leave the country for more than 4 or 5 days during 76 until the doctors were happy that my blood was back to normal again. So that put the kibosh on that. The decision was taken to just do 4 days at the Nürburgring. So we were there in 76 and not far away from where Lauda had his accident, because we watched that race from the Adenauer Bridge. Um, but um, But nobody knew how serious the accident was. I mean, we knew that there'd been an accident and there was a restart and some of the cars were missing and one of them was Lauda. But not until we got back to Calais on the way home and we picked up the English radio did we hear how seriously injured Lauda was. And so, obviously that was for him to come back the way he did in 77 and he won third time out in the South African Grand Prix. He then won the German Grand Prix that year, but obviously it had moved to Hockenheim and then in front of us won the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort after a great battle with Jacques Lafitte.
Well, this brings us quite nicely to the top 10 drivers. I think we can do that at this point. So I looked up the Autocourse top 10 and the Autosport top 10 drivers for the year. Now, the Autocourse had Lauda first, whereas Autosport had Andretti first. Now, given what we've said about the latest 78 and the fact that not only had Lauda come back from that horrendous accident, but was pretty much working against Ferrari, or at least had certain factions within Ferrari not entirely to his liking, is perhaps a better way of putting it, to go out and win the championship in those circumstances. I know that Andretti was very unlucky with his development costs with DFEs. Let's face it, if they'd had normal DFEs, he would have been world champion that year as well. I kind of think I'm leaning towards putting Lauda first. Is that fair?
I think that's fair to say, because let's face it, Lauda won three races in a Ferrari that we probably didn't appreciate at the time how obsolete it was getting. And that was only one Grand Prix fewer than Andretti in the Lotus that at the time we didn't appreciate how Lotus was moving the goalposts in Formula One car design. He did it in what became known as the Lauda way. But it's funny, everyone thinks back to Niki Lauda and thinks the Teutonically efficient way of winning world championships. But if you go back to 1974, that was only 3 years before his first year at Ferrari, he took 9 pole positions, didn't he, out of the 15 Grand Prix. So he was blooming fast. I think the calculated way of winning world titles came to him post-accident, and that obviously worked extremely well in a very closely matched season like 1977, where you've got the stats in front of you there. But I know he won 3 Grand Prix, and I know he only failed to score points twice, didn't he, in the days when points only went down to 6.
Absolutely.
But podium-wise, seconds and thirds, he had a lot, didn't he?
Yeah, it was 10 podiums, and he didn't start in Spain, and he didn't bother with the last 2 races. So it's not actually from 17 races, it's 10 podiums from 14, which in a car that, if you look at the raw stats in terms of qualifying, is actually the 4th fastest car.
So I would
argue that Lauda probably did deserve to be world champion there. I mean, no disrespect to Andretti, who was part of that Lotus rebuild as well and did a lot of the work with the Gran FX car as well. So to say, Andretti had the fastest car that he helped produce. Lauda did the best job. Perhaps the fastest driver in the championship, though, was probably James Hunt, bearing in mind that he managed 6 poles across the ancient M23, which Gilles Villeneuve preferred driving to the Ferrari when he drove the 312 T2, and I prefer the McLaren, which perhaps gives you backs up your point about nobody had realised quite how uncompetitive Ferrari was becoming at that point.
Well, that's right. When Gilles Villeneuve got into the Ferrari for the last 2 Grand Prix after Niki Lauda decided that he really couldn't be bothered to work for Ferrari anymore, he was way down, wasn't he? Qualifying performances. And we'd seen him make that astonishing debut at Silverstone in the McLaren M23, as you say. So that Ferrari, wasn't a great car. But I think you're right, James Hunt probably was the quickest driver that year. And a lot of people have said, and I wouldn't disagree, that he drove better in 77 than he did in 76 when he won the world championship.
Yeah, this, the criticisms of Hunt from 77, aside from perhaps the Zandvoort clash, tend to be his off-track antics, because yes. he got himself into a few scrapes, didn't he? But on track, he had that, I guess, that confidence of having been world champion. Mm. I mean, even in 76, he'd been thrown into McLaren quite late, but he knew the N23, he knew the team. The N26 actually did come good as well. Mm. Six pole positions across an old car and a new underdeveloped one is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it didn't really come together. I mean, it was the first half of the season was just a run of dismal luck, misjudgment, whatever. But it wasn't until the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, which I think I'm right in saying was as late as round 10, wasn't it? Because the season was quite heavily loaded towards the first half of the year. Where he took pole position and won the race, and that really kind of kick-started his 77 season, albeit it was led for much of the race by John Watson in the Brabham Alpha, who I'm sure we'll come on to.
Well, we could do that now, couldn't we? Because actually, when I was talking then about the raw speed of the cars, Lotus was the fastest by some margin, then McLaren, thanks to James's qualifying laps, I suspect. Fourth was Ferrari, but third was the Brabham Alfa Romeo, which didn't win a race. Yeah. In fact, when I did a top 10 best F1 cars not to win a World Championship Grand Prix, I think I ended up putting that number one a few years back and spoke to John Watson about it. But they'd sort of lost. I guess we have to talk about losing Carlos Pacho as well early in the season, and Wasi having to take over, and then just having pretty much every which way to lose a race.
Well, yeah.
Obviously, the previous couple of seasons, they'd had the two car losses, Reutemann and Pace, and Reutemann had gone off to Ferrari for 77, and Pace was supposed to be the team leader, and John Watson joining from Penske for the 77 season. That was a nice lineup, but I'm pretty sure Pace was second in one of the South American Grand Prix at the start of the season.
Argentinian Grand Prix,
which was a good enough, and that was a race in January summer heat in Argentina, which only about seven cars finished.
January the 9th.
Yeah,
that's right.
So that boded quite well for the season, after the opening races of the season, Carlos Pacho lost his life in a light aircraft crash in South America, which meant that John Watson was leading the team and they needed a second driver. They got Hans Stuck in, which was probably a decent choice, bearing in mind who was available at the time. John Watson became a bit of a favourite among the motorsport puritans, who I would probably suggest that me and my dad were very much in that group, in the sense that he wasn't a playboy like James Hunt. He was just a sort of proper racing driver, and also so unlucky. I mean, the Brabham Alpha of that year was horrendously unreliable. Talking to John in recent years, it needed a lot of fuel because the Alpha engine was very thirsty, and there were so many retirements that season, and I think he only ended up with about 9 points or something.
He was 13th in the championship with 9 points.
But there was the heartbreak of losing the French Grand Prix at Dijon right at the end. Then next time out at Silverstone, he's on the front row with James Hunt, gets a better start, and he's leading him for most of the race. And then it was a fuel system problem struck deep into the second half of the race, it was just one of those seasons where nothing went right for them, really. It must have been a decent car, because Niki Lauda wouldn't have decided to.
It looked amazing. Jumped too, that red martini.
It was
a cool looking car. I think obviously that was Bernie Ecclestone era Brabham, and I think he said in the past that Pacho, he thinks, could have been a championship contending driver, not necessarily in 77.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's Do you think that's fair? Have we seen enough of him to suggest that he was going to be that good?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I love the 70s, not just because I was a young lad during that era, but it was just so equally matched. And if you remember a few years ago, in Autosport, I did a top 10 drivers with John Watson from that era, and it was just brilliant because there was no one ever as dominant as, say, Alain Prost or Ayrton Senna, or more recently Michael Schumacher, or, you know, these days Max Verstappen. Well, not this season, obviously, but the past few seasons. It just seemed very. You would go into a season with no idea who was going to come out on top. I mean, you would even go into a race weekend with no idea who was going to come out on top. It was just so even. And so Carlos Parche, yes, he could well have been. And I do remember that quote. I think Bernie Ecclestone said, had Carlos Parche survived, he would never have needed Niki Lauda.
That's right, yeah. Well, you never know with Bernie if there's some other motivation at the time. He's trying to get a deal out of Niki for some reason or whatever.
So yeah, was he in that top bracket? We'll probably never know.
No. And I guess while we're on the sort of darker side of it, which I suppose would be one argument against 1977, but then again, if you discounted every season where there was a serious accident or a fatality, there'd be a lot of years prior to the mid-1980s that would get themselves discounted. But of course, Tom Price and his horrendous accident in South Africa, I don't think we need to go into it other than to say it was one of the worst accidents in F1 and deprived us of someone else that probably could have been a Grand Prix winner at very least.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd been at Silverstone in 1975 with my dad when he put the shadow on pole position, and he was a great favourite among the British motorsport fans.
It's entertaining to watch as well.
You're absolutely right. It was always viewed as a good year when there wasn't at least one fatality in Formula One, and that's just Formula One. Look at the rest of the sport as well. And as I said to you before, there was very limited media coverage of it, and you actually got used to if you switched on the radio during the day when there was a big race on and you heard the motor racing driver, then insert name there, you knew it was probably a death because that was the extent of the coverage of Formula One and top level motor racing in those days before it was regularly televised. So, I distinctly remember it was the first Saturday of March. South African Grand Prix, we had the radio on at home, and it was the motor racing driver Tom Price has been killed in an accident in the South African Grand Prix. As I said, he was a favourite among the British motorsport fans, and it was tremendously sad, but it was kind of not unexpected that it would happen to at least one of them in a season. And I remember the following day we went to Silverstone for the ridiculously early in the year opening round of the European Formula 2 Championship. It's just the sport carried on as normal, really. It was obviously very sad. Out of, and the other, the unfortunate thing in those days was that a lot of drivers got their opportunities from tragic occurrences like that. And the death of Tom Price in the South African Grand Prix at last gave Alan Jones a firm drive with the shadow team in Formula One. And he really grasped that, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was on the notes to talk about for sure, because I also did a list of the worst cars to win a Grand Prix, and the 1977 Shadow got onto it because it was a top six car at best. I mean, Alan Jones got a reputation for not being brilliant at qualifying, but being a good racer, and you could kind of see it even during 77. And of course, he came through to win at the Austrian Grand Prix from 14th on the grid. He did need a little bit of help. I think it was going to be second, wasn't it? But Hunt's McLaren went bang because James was pretty good in damp conditions as well. But at that point, with hindsight, it's easy to go, oh, yeah, he was gonna make it. But was that the feeling, or was that a feeling of one of those? Because we had one-off winners like Vittorio Brambilla, Gunnar Nielsen won that year. Yeah. Or was there a feeling that, oh, maybe this Australian's got something a bit more about him?
It was viewed as a good plucky underdog win. But the thing is, the Austrian Grand Prix had a habit of doing that during the mid-70s. So, Alan Jones won it in 77. John Watson in the Penske won it in 76. And Vittorio Brambilla had won it in the March in 75. So it always threw up that kind of odd result. I don't think anyone realised that Alan Jones was going to be a future world champion at the time, except for possibly Alan Jones. but he was someone that, you know, we'd seen racing in Atlantic and Formula 5000 in the UK, and he was a sort of gritty Australian who was always there or thereabouts, and sometimes mega quick on his day. But transfer that into a Formula One environment, and would he be world champion? And nobody really thought that. But also, he had a very, very young teammate who came into the shadow team from the Monaco Grand Prix onwards, but didn't do the whole season because not all the races didn't clash with his Formula 2 commitments. That was Riccardo Patrese. And in hindsight, actually, I think for Riccardo Patrese to have done the job he did against Alan Jones in his first season probably showed him to be a talent that maybe we didn't appreciate at the time.
He had some pretty good teammates during his career in the end, didn't he, Patrese? Yeah. Alan Jones at the start, and he had some bloke called Mark Schumacher at the end, in between Nelson Piquet and Nigel Mansell. He had quite a run of it. Perhaps we should do a podcast on Riccardo Patrese. I think he's working on a book at the moment, so perhaps we could. I wonder if we could persuade him to join us.
That would be a good read.
That could be quite good, wouldn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So, well, we've managed to get quite a long way into this podcast without mentioning the name of the person that finished second in the championship, which is amazing. But it backs up your point about you could never really predict what was happening, because Jody Scheckter joined, okay, it wasn't an entirely new team, was it? But Wolf. And then they came out and won the first race of the season, and he ends up beating everyone but Lauda in the championship. Pretty amazing, really.
It was fantastic. Yeah. So what the Canadian oil magnate Walter Wolf got into Formula One via a partnership with Frank Williams, and that the cars were dismally uncompetitive, and they split in during the 1976 season, and Walter Wolf decided to set up on his own with Harvey Postlethwaite from Hesketh as the designer, Peter Waugh from Lotus as the team manager, and Jody Scheckter, who didn't like driving six-wheeled Tyrrells at all, and was therefore very approachable to lead the driver line. And when I say lead the driver line, of course, the other thing I loved about that era is that there were one car teams, and that's what Wolf was in 1977. So Jody Scheckter on his own, it was a beautiful car, and they won the first Grand Prix in Argentina from middle of the grid, I think 13th, but stand to be corrected on that. And that was pretty much...
Was he 13?
11.
11.
So it was an odd number, but you've given him an extra row to overtake.
But that was lasting in a race of attrition, but the car was actually really quick as well. And Scheckter won the Monaco Grand Prix in it after a battle with early battle with John Watson in the Brabham, and then went on to win the Canadian Grand Prix as well, and Jody Scheckter was one of the fastest drivers of the 1970s, absolutely no question about it. He was in a good car, the focus was completely on him because it was a one car team, and he ran fantastically well in that first season.
And actually, every time that he finished, if you, Japan to one side, he was on the podium when that car finished. So that's pretty impressive. And actually, I think, didn't he lose a win at Long Beach with a puncture?
That's right.
Which handed it over to Andretti. That's so a rare occasion where Andretti lucked into a win in that season.
Yeah, Long Beach. He led right up until about two laps from the finish, didn't he? Yeah.
So I'm just taking a look down the winners list of people we haven't mentioned. So we'll see Andretti on four, Lauda on three, Scheckter on three, Hunt on three, Carlos Reutemann in the other Ferrari one, but I think Lauda got on top of him fairly quickly, didn't he? They didn't really like each other very well. Lauda didn't like him. I don't know what Carlos thought of Nicky.
Well, it was... I feel a bit sorry for Carlos Reutemann, really, because
it wasn't really his fault what happened before, I suppose.
You're struggling along in 1976 with a hugely unreliable Brabham Alpha, and then Ferrari come knocking because Niki Lauda's injured and they need a replacement, and so he quite willingly jumped ship, and then obviously Niki Lauda returned to a fit enough state to drive a racing car much sooner than anyone could have imagined, and was took huge umbrage that Reutemann had been drafted in. So, and it was So his win came very early in the season at Interlagos, didn't it? In the second race of 77. Yeah, Lauda got absolutely on top of him, Reutemann was quite consistent that season, but
he fought in the championship, actually, we should mention.
Yeah, but in hindsight, as quick as we all know Reutemann was, that's another plus point for Lauda in 77, as far as I'm concerned, because he absolutely demolished him, really, didn't he, across the season. And
probably contrasting mental fragility across those two is probably Reutemann needed everything to be kind of perfect, and then he was almost unbeatable.
Yeah.
But that only happened once or twice a season, whereas Lauda would just grind out something every time, wouldn't he? Well, our other winners that we haven't got to, so Gunnar Nielsen. A well-taken win, actually. I know it's his only one, but
it was.
He did require teammate Andretti to punt Watson up the backside on a rare error from Andretti in 77.
At Zolder, yes, and another case of Watson bad luck that season, really, but it's one that people tend to forget because it happened at the start of the race rather than the end of it. But, yeah, Gunnar Nielsen was someone that that we followed quite keenly, because we'd seen him win a lot of Formula 3 races in the 75 season with the Works March team. So he was a real up and coming driver of that era, and sort of unexpectedly got more or less a full season with Lotus in 76. That's more a illustration of where Lotus were at, that nobody from the top draw wanted to drive for them at the time, until Andretti came back after the Parnelli team had folded early in the 76 season, and did a really good job. And he was, apart from the win in the Belgian Grand Prix, which was one of those wet, dry races where you had to sort of pit at the right time and get your slicks on, I'm pretty sure he also finished a really good third at the British Grand Prix that year. Yeah. But then his form tailed off, and we didn't find out until later that he was already beginning to feel some pain from what tragically claimed his life in October of the following year, the testicular cancer. So, that was obviously enormously sad, because he was taking a bold decision for 78 to join the new Arrows team. He was definitely someone who should have won a few Grand Prix over the next few years, I would have said.
Mm. He suffered from poor reliability as well with the Lotus in that season. Well, we've got one more winner to talk about from that season, which I know there's a smile on your face already. Now, you mentioned that the Oesterreichring threw up some odd winners during the era, but so did Anderstorp, didn't it? And you've got to say that the Swedish Grand Prix in 77 was one of those, huh? Moments, surely.
Well, there were Jacques Lafitte. I can't believe we've got
so long into a podcast where I'm reminiscing about the 1970s.
You've been very restrained.
And we've not yet mentioned Ligier. So that it's just another one car team, as I was describing the Wolf team with Jody Scheckter. The Ligier was a nice looking car, and it had the Matra V12 engine in it, which just sounded absolutely fantastic. It was not the most consistently competitive car, but Jacques Lafitte always raced well. The Anderstorp still is an odd circuit. It's in the sense that it had these long, constant radius, slightly banked corners. And funnily enough, the other circuit where he was really quick was Zandvoort, which also has fairly long corners. A couple of the corners there are banked. And he was battling with Niki Lauda all the way to the finish of that one. So obviously I love that because I was a Lauda fan and a Lafitte fan. So
12 cylinder deal. Yeah,
24 cylinders altogether. Yeah. So that was, he was, they were a team that were, it was only their second year in Formula One and they stuck with the Matra until the end of 78, and then suddenly they switched to the Cosworth for 79, and they were winning everything at the start of the season, of course. But they're inconsistent. There were stories at the time that some of the Matra V12 engines were better than others, which perhaps explains why they weren't consistently competitive across the season. But
I think that's probably true of the era, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
both in terms of tyres, engines, cars. Yeah. There was a lot of more variety and inconsistency. Yeah. Like quality control now. Yeah. If you've got a faster car by a tenth, we know that teams tend to, they more often than not, they find that tenth, and that's the order. Whereas back in the 70s, the order changed quite consistently, didn't it?
There was no quality control in the 70s, was there, really?
Which brings us to some of the cars at the back, perhaps. Yeah. I don't know if you've got any. I mean, I was just looking at the list. Some of the random cars. Obviously, you had older cars, sometimes run by privateer teams, but also things like the Kojima and the Maguire and the Apollon. The Apollon, I can't even remember. I remember the other two.
Well, the Apollon was a reworked Williams when Williams's
before
were
Williams were good.
When Williams's were really terrible by Loris Kessel and his team. The Maguire was also a reworked Williams. That was Brian Maguire, who me and my dad had seen win a Shell Sport International round in that car at Thruxton in 76. The Kojima was the Japanese Grand Prix only car everyone wanted to see them come to Europe, but they never did. They were all Enzyme. They were they had Clay Regazzoni, who'd come from 3 years at Ferrari. Well, more than that, but a 3 year stretch at Ferrari from 74 to 76 to drive for Enzyme in 77. He actually said at the time that he preferred driving for Enzyme. The only thing that he'd rather have from his Ferrari days was the engine. And that was it.
It's quite a good little chassis, wasn't it?
Yeah. Although when Patrick Tombay came in at the British Grand Prix in the second Enzyme, which was actually entered under the Theodore Racing banner, he was every bit as impressive as Villeneuve, actually. A lot of people forget that. Regatz only failed to qualify that weekend. And I remember being in the Silverstone paddock, and there was a group of people waiting outside the Enzyme caravan. And when I say caravan, I literally mean caravan, no motorhome or anything like that. It had probably been towed there by Maurice Marina or something. And Regazzoni was sitting at a table in there with a couple of members of the team. And I joined these people waiting because I thought, oh, it'd be good to have his autograph. And he just called out of the caravan. He went, tomorrow. And I said to my dad, well, he's not going to be here tomorrow because he hasn't qualified. So I never got his autograph.
Oh, dear.
So, Hesketh as well, we've not mentioned, who
it was Hesketh Mark II, wasn't it, really?
And Rupert Keegan managed to put in a decent qualifying effort at the British Grand Prix, but they were at Zandvoort, where we went, they were running three cars. They had Hector Aback and Ian Ashley as well. They probably only had the resources to run one, really. Fittipaldi, that's another one. I mean, it's
Nigel Roebuck in his season really laments the wasted talent of Emerson Fittipaldi, his brother's team.
It was really, wasn't it?
Having walked out of a perfectly competitive McLaren M23. The last thing we have to cover off, and that you witnessed, is the arrival of two things really that were going to have a big impact on Formula One over the next few years, in the shape of the turbocharged Renault with Michelin tyres. Even though they were a laughing stock to start with, and they couldn't finish a race, didn't start a lot of races, and didn't finish any.
Yes, well, we liked Jean-Pierre Jabouille because we'd seen him do good things in Formula 2, and obviously he'd won the championship in 76 in Formula 2, so thoroughly deserved to be in Formula 1. This Renault came out on the Thursday, first practice and qualifying day for the British Grand Prix. Couldn't believe how quiet it was.
Get used to that.
But, no, but
even compared to later turbos,
you'll remember V6 turbos of the mid 80s, absolute proper scream from them. But it was called the Yellow Teapot at the time. And it was more like a whistle sound. It sounded awful, didn't like it at all. But I was only 10 at the time. I didn't appreciate the technology or anything like that. And obviously, it was not only leading the way on turbocharged engines in Formula One, but also Michelin radial tyres were going to change that picture as well. I remember my dad being very cross that the Renault had gone straight through to conventional qualifying on the Thursday and not had to do pre-qualifying on the Wednesday because they were a new entrant. it didn't qualify very well at Silverstone. I think 20th or 21st.
Yeah. And actually, we're only 1.6 off pole, which wasn't too terrible.
Another
really.
Thing, that was the first time a Grand Prix had all 26 cars within 2 seconds of each other in qualifying. So that's how close things were in those days. They then went away and missed the German and Austrian Grand Prix. So our trip to the Dutch Grand Prix was the second appearance for the Renault, and they didn't do much on the first day, but then the second day he suddenly put it in the top 10, I think, on the grid, and suddenly you're thinking, hang on a minute, here's a serious proposition. And it never actually looked as though it was going that quickly, but I think part of that is down to sound as well, and because it was so quiet, it's a bit like, you remember when the diesel Audis were in?
Oh, the turbo diesels at Le Mans.
Yeah. So they were unspectacular, probably because you couldn't hear them. But actually, if you just focus completely on what you could see, they were absolutely amazing. And I think that was. It was very early days for turbocharging. Gratifyingly, they got a lot noisier.
Well, of course, within a year, they'd won Le Mans.
Yeah.
2 years, they'd won a Grand Prix. Mm. And they should have won a World Championship, didn't they, Renault, at some point during that period. They never quite got it done for reliability reasons, really. But yes. And of course, I think there's an argument to say that without the Michelin radial on the Ferrari in 1978, the Lotus 79 would have been even further ahead.
Oh yeah,
but the Michelins were probably the best tyre, weren't they, that year, and kind of made the gap look a bit smaller than it actually was. And of course, we all ended up with radials and turbos within, well, I'd say 5-6 years or so.
and some of the most spectacular Formula One cars ever seen. So turbos weren't that bad, really, were they?
No, well done Renault, despite the year we're looking at, perhaps not the time that they'd be looking back to most fondly. But are there any other highlights that you'd like to pick on, any more arguments for saying why 1977 was so mega, before I ask the listeners to email us in with why you're wrong?
it was it was mega in the viewpoint of a 10-year-old boy who was just getting, as I said before, absolutely obsessed about motorsport in general. And I will absolutely not argue with other people's suggestions. And I know we've been chatting with a colleague this morning about a year that's at least two decades after this one. I won't give anything away.
Yeah, no, that'll be a future episode.
But I'm not going to disagree with him because he's younger than I am, and he will have his own reasons for that. But I just thought 77, it was just a brilliant crossroads of teams on the up, teams on the down, great characters among the drivers, where there were several of them on the same level and were world champion material, and more than several were capable of winning Grand Prix. The cars you had a lot of Cosworth DFE engines, nothing wrong with that anyway, as far as I'm concerned. But you also had the sound of the Ferrari and the Alfa and the Matra and the Renault and the BRM, of course, when it lasted.
I mean, not very often, to be fair, by then.
During pre-qualifying.
Yeah, once or twice, yeah.
Just like primary coloured racing cars, most of them admittedly in the colours of cigarette advertising, but it just, the cars look great. And it's also, that other cliche where if you took the cars and painted them all white from that era, you'd still be able to tell which car was the Surtees, which was the Shadow, which was the Ferrari, which was the March, etc. They were just so distinctive.
Well, and of course, that is the last year that we have the six-wheeled Tyrrell.
Yes. That would be the easiest one, wouldn't it?
But Ronnie Peterson, in pretty much any other discussion about a year in the 1970s, we'd be talking about Ronnie Peterson as one of the stars, but he had a terrible year with the six-wheeler.
And beaten by
Depailler, really, in the other car, which is quite unusual. But I think Ken had had enough of that idea, but Ken Tyrrell had enough of the idea by the end of that season, didn't he?
Well, I think to be fair, Jody Scheckter had warned them in 76 that I won't use Jody Scheckter language on a family podcast, but so Depailler plugged on for 77. Peterson needed somewhere to go, and it was an unmitigated disaster. And also the first year since Tyrrell's entry to Formula One in 1968 with the Matra that they'd never won a Grand Prix. They didn't win many after that, to be honest, but at least they did win a handful, didn't they? Including in 78 Monaco with Depailler, with the conventional 008, which was a much nicer looking car than the P34.
Yes, less distinctive, but probably prettier. Yeah. That's probably fair. Yes. Well, that's a good case been made for 1977 as Marcus's favourite F1 season. But let us know what you think. Drop us a line, autosport@autosport.com. You can do that anytime during the series, really. Tell us what year you would pick and why. And maybe if we get enough years that are mentioned, or enough votes for the same year that we haven't covered by one of our guests, maybe we'll do a couple of special episodes to cover that off. I'm going to guess now that 1994 will not be appearing in anyone's list. Surely that's banned. We vetoed 1994. We're not doing a podcast on that being the best F1 season. But otherwise, pretty much anything goes. So yes. Well, thank you very much, Marcus Simmons. Thank you very much to the listeners. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast.